coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Talking to kids about the coronavirus can be a difficult thing for parents who are also dealing with uncertainty and stress.
Saying to them, please come ask me questions if you have them. I'm happy to talk to you, but not dwelling on it. So trying to find that balance is pretty tricky.
We chat with a pediatric psychologist about helping children navigate the coronavirus outbreak. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear how local schools are getting ready to teach their students at home and how the University of Delaware's online classes will work. And we have more on how businesses and workers are struggling to cope with an economy that's largely come to a screeching halt. It's all up next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It is difficult to get a grip on just how much damage the coronavirus pandemic will ultimately do to the economy nationwide and here in the First State. But we are starting to get an initial sense of its scope, both in hard numbers and anecdotally. Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle spent the week talking with businesses and workers affected and looking at the available data. He brings together what he found in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to discuss what he learned. Let's start with the numbers. You know, what do we know right now about job losses, and how bad do some economists think this is going to get?
Well, this week we have had official statistics from the Delaware Department of Labor, and they are showing an astonishing rise in the number of first-time claims for jobless benefits. What the DOL told us is that for the week ending March 21st, there were 10,790 first-time claims for jobless benefits. Now, to put that in some perspective, Tom, that is bigger than for any whole month for the last 30 years, according to what the DOL is telling us. And that is, and this 10,000 number, just to emphasize, is just for a single week. It's also much higher than the monthly high at the worst point of the recession of 2008-2009. We should also put this in a national perspective. And at the same time, the federal government released jobless claims data for the same period of time. What that has shown is there were new claims numbered 3.3 million, and that is more than four times higher than the previous record, which was in 1982, and obviously also further beyond what we saw at the low point of the 2008-2009 recession. So it's very bad, according to those numbers. Now, numerous economists have been putting out forecasts about how bad this might get. And one of those forecasts comes from a think tank called the Economic Policy Institute. And what they are predicting is that Delaware will lose 16,700 private sector jobs just by June, and that would account for 4.2% of the workforce. And it has to be said that that is not even the most bleak of the surveys out there. The EPI is saying that it's kind of in the mid-range of forecasts. So it's looking pretty bleak.
You talked to some businesses this week, restaurants and some other small service-oriented operations. And they're really caught between trying to help their employees, who they know, as we can see from those numbers, are really hurting, and trying to keep their businesses afloat. And that's a really tough balancing act to strike, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is. I spoke to the owner of one restaurant chain based in Hokesson. He has got three locations altogether, another one in Wilmington, another one in Newark. And the Wilmington and Newark locations have been closed down. He is keeping his Hokesson operation going just purely to provide takeout and delivery services as permitted by the state, by Governor Carney's order. But the net result of this for his workforce is that he's let go 43 of his 50 employees, and he was telling me that how much this hurts to do this, and he really feels so bad that people who have relied on him for a paycheck can no longer do so, at least while this is going on, and so the net result for him so far is that he's lost about 75% of his revenue. I was also talking to a commercial carpet cleaning company, just as an indication that this is a very broad-based economic effect. It's not just hitting the hospitality and restaurant industry. This Wilmington-based company, they say that they lost 50%. They've lost 50% of their revenue, have avoided layoffs so far, they may have to revisit that situation in about 2 weeks if nothing changes.
Well, and obviously, as I think everybody knows at this point, that the restaurant hospitality sector seems to be the hardest hit. You mentioned it just a moment ago with that one operation. What numbers-wise, what are we looking at right now in terms of that sector in particular?
Well, the Delaware Restaurant Association says that they expect to lose between 20,000 and 25,000 jobs as a result of this situation, and that would represent about half of their statewide workforce. It's worth noting here that going back to the EPI projection that we talked about a minute ago, about what that shows is that about 26% of Delaware's private sector workforce is in related industries, is in hospitality, leisure, and retail industries, which indicates the state's pretty high degree of exposure.
And clearly, staying afloat by just offering takeout isn't really going to work out for a lot of these places, right?
Well, that's right. I spoke with one restaurant owner in Rehoboth. He's got two locations down there. What he said was that he initially, after he closed his sit-down restaurant, closed the restaurants on March 22nd, and initially started offering delivery and takeout services. But the main reason he did that, he said, was because he just wanted to get rid of his inventory so that he didn't have rotting food on his premises, and so after that inventory was delivered, then he shut down because he said that it just it wasn't worth it to him to offer that service.
And as you mentioned earlier, I mean, this isn't just restaurants and bars. I mean, there's a lot of other service-based industries that are also in peril at this point.
Well, indeed, I spoke with a yoga studio down near Bethany Beach. This is a husband and wife operation, and they're still offering their yoga lessons, but only online because of course everybody's been urged to quarantine and stay in their houses. And so they are getting some revenue from that, it's only kind of a partially successful idea because some of their clients are older folks who are apparently not willing to kind of adapt to using their computers to take the yoga lessons. And so the result of that situation is that company has laid off six teachers, all of whom are contractors, and their revenue has fallen by about three quarters.
How about workers? I mean, we know the federal government will likely be sending out direct payment checks to most Americans next month. Unemployment benefits are being expanded substantially. We just ran a story yesterday about the Delaware Restaurant Association starting a fund. They're trying to get workers in that industry $500 each as soon as possible. But is that enough? Is it coming fast enough for those workers to pay the basic bills?
According to some of the folks that I've spoken to, the answer is no. It seems unlikely that people are going to be made whole as a result of unemployment benefits or any assistance that they might get from the federal government. So, for example, I was speaking with a lady who is a bartender in Christiana, and she was saying that she normally makes about $7.50 a week after her salary and her tips are added up, and now she's down to less than a third of that, which would include only $167 a week in jobless benefits. So she's obviously way below her normal income, and she's concerned that she's not going to be able to pay rent, and she doesn't know what she's going to do after maybe another month.
So are people looking for other jobs, and if they are, can they even find any?
Several people I spoke with are looking for other jobs, but none of them reported they've been able to find any. The bartender I just referred to said that she had applied to 15 retail stores and hadn't had any success. And she'd also applied to Amazon, which of course is a major employer, but hadn't had any success there either. And then the gentleman who runs the yoga studio down near Bethany Beach was telling me that he has some experience as a house painter, and he said he would consider taking work as a house painter if it was available, if he could find it. But he was kind of nervous about that because he would be concerned about with the coronavirus putting himself in harm's way by coming into contact with any other occupants of the buildings that he worked in. So he hadn't found that work, and it sounded likely that he wasn't going to try too hard to get that.
So I guess in a lot of ways what we're talking about here is kind of a race against time. I mean, you know, we see these big job numbers from last week. Any relief that's going to come from the government, state or federal, is probably a few weeks away. It just seems like there's a gap there that a lot of people are going to wind up falling into.
That's right. I think it varies depending on which businesses you're talking to. I spoke with the carpet cleaning business, and the owner of that said that that he could make it. He was hoping to get through the next 2 weeks, without having any layoffs. But he thought that, you know, but if he got to that stage and found that things were not beginning to reopen, then he would have to consider layoffs or part-time working for his workforce. Somebody else, the restaurateur down in Rehoboth, said that he thought he would be okay until May 15th. And that's his target for trying to get his restart his business for the all important summer season. But it's really unclear as to, you know, how long people can hang on.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. You can read his reporting on the initial economic impact of the coronavirus outbreak right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next on The Green, we take a look at the education landscape in the first state as schools try to teach kids from home rather than in the classroom. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Schools in the first state will remain closed until at least May 15th under Governor John Carney's emergency order. That means at least a month and a half more of schools trying to educate students remotely. The challenge of doing that is a huge one, and Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nagengast checked in this week with districts and schools around the state to see how they're faring. And in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, he reports approaches and preparedness vary. Larry joined me this week to discuss it more. I want to start with, I guess, what I thought was one of the big takeaways from your piece, and that is that perhaps private schools and charters may be faring a bit better in this kind of conversion to remote learning with smaller populations, fewer moving parts to deal with. Is that a fair generalization?
From talking to a mix of 8 schools and districts, both public and private, I think it's a fair generalization, but I really can't offer a guarantee that this is what you're going to find across the board. There are two factors clearly working in the favor of the charters and the independent schools. Not only are they smaller than a school district, but their student populations tend to be less diverse. I'm not talking about a racial characterization here, but what I'm saying is that private schools tend to have more affluent families. Charter schools tend to have more highly motivated parents and students, while districts tend to have a mix of everything. So it's often easier for the private schools and the charter schools to commit to making a laser-type focus on the needs of their particular student demographic.
Some of the schools you talk to are trying to migrate online as much as possible. What are some examples of what this online learning looks like for students in K through 12?
Well, it's fair to say that just about everybody's in a different place, and no two schools, no two districts are going to be alike. So if you're a parent, if you've got kids in school, what you might experience in your district is very likely to be somewhat different from what the experience are going to be of someone else with children in a different school. Now, while we're talking about migrating online, we really don't mean that kids are going to be sitting in front of a computer screen for 6 hours a day. Programming is also going to vary by grade levels. A couple of examples here. Charter School of Wilmington, they're going to be offering classes online in the morning, and then students will have their afternoons free for reading and research. At Sussex Academy, a charter school, middle school and high school in Georgetown, 2 days a week are going to be devoted to online class instruction, and then two more days for research and homework, and then Fridays are going to be a day dedicated to tutoring, one-on-one chats with teachers and counselors, that sort of thing. Now, if your kids are in lower grades, you can expect a mix of learning packets. You know, these are worksheets that have been delivered, may have been delivered already to students. Some schools gave them out the last day before classes broke up, and the online instruction. And you've got some terminology here that you've got to get used to, too, because at all of these levels, the online work is going to be either synchronous, which means it's delivered in real time by the teacher, or asynchronous, which means it's recorded by the teacher and available for access at a time that works for the student.
But going online is not an easy proposition. Access certainly can be a barrier for many. What are some of the problems and some of the solutions that schools are dealing with?
I'll start with the solution rather than the problem, the asynchronous lessons that I just mentioned. Now, let's go to the problem. At least the problem for families that do have devices and Internet access. Due to the state of emergency, we've got more people working from home, if they're fortunate enough to be working at all, and there might very well be more than one school-aged child in the family. So that means that we've got some competition for use of the Internet, use of the computer. So there are going to be discussions about who gets to the computer and when, and don't be surprised if mom or dad's got a work deadline that takes priority over the kid's geometry class. See, this is where the asynchronous lesson comes in. Mom can use the computer to get her project done, and then Johnny can log on to the school site and listen to the geometry lesson. Now, there are going to be families that don't have Internet access, don't have enough devices, whatever. And those students are, to a greater extent, going to be learning in the old-fashioned way, sitting at the kitchen table with worksheets that have been prepared by their teachers. As I noted, some schools began handing them out 2 weeks ago on the last day before the shutdown. Now their schools are going to have to distribute the packets in a variety of ways. Some schools are delivering them by bus at the same time as they deliver meals to the kids who qualify for free and reduced price lunches. Other schools are planning to ask parents to pick up the packets at school, say once a week, and they'll likely to have systems where they'll put a bin out, different colored bins out in front of the school, and this is for first grade work, this is second grade work, and so on. Of course, another issue that someone mentioned to me is that sooner or later these teachers are going to want to quiz their students, and that's going to mean, if it's a pen and paper quiz, that the quiz papers are going to have to be returned to the school for grading. And that's something that they haven't quite figured out yet.
So we talked a little bit earlier about private schools. Charters seem to be a bit more comfortable with this transition. School districts, of course, much larger. I suppose their challenges may be different. We've kind of alluded to some of them here. What did you find out from the districts?
As I mentioned, the diversity within the demographics of school districts makes their challenges more difficult. You need a wider range of programming. Districts tend to have larger percentages of special needs students, and children with physical disabilities have needs that that can be different from others, and that's something that's got to be taken into consideration as well. Also, from what I've been hearing, there's a greater need at the district level to train teachers in how to deliver online instruction. And now, I mean, when you think about it, if you're a charter school or a private school, you might have a staff of 10 or 20 teachers or whatever. And if you're a high school or a larger school district, you've got hundreds of teachers. So it's easier to get 10 teachers operating on the same program and then to deal with hundreds. So you've got that training issue. And then on top of that, one of the superintendents I talked to mentioned that the traditional school district contracts establish a 188-day school work year. So with the schools closed for the last 2 weeks, in the mind of the district officials was that those days were going to be filled up into the schedule later on. So they pretty much didn't have their teachers doing anything for most of the past 2 weeks because they figured, those days weren't work days, which would have originally been work days now, are going to be work days later. So they weren't doing much. And then maybe 2 days ago, they said, whoops, we gotta go now. We know what's happening next. And all of a sudden, there's this last minute sort of push giving them the instructions and what the expectations and planning is going to be to move to the online. Some of that is being put together fairly quickly. I think it's fair to say that there's really a lot of finger crossing going on at the district level right now, hoping that things do work out right.
So right now, schools are closed until May 15th. How much thought are districts and schools giving to how a return to school might look, or the possibility they may stay closed even longer?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the people I talk to are hoping that the schools actually do reopen on Monday, May 18th. And if that doesn't happen, well, I guess that's going to be a bridge that they're willing to cross later. A decision on reopening isn't going to be made on May 15th. It would probably be made a week or so earlier. Anyhow, the districts are currently looking at their calendar. They're figuring out how many days the teachers have already worked, how many days the students have already been in class, and trying to decide what they can reasonably add on to the calendar up until June 30th, which is the last day of school, no matter what, according to the governor's order. Now, some of the charter schools who kept on teaching over the past 2 weeks, say they don't expect to extend their school year. The head of the Sussex Academy, located not too far from the beaches, also points out that, at least in his situation, the extension's not going to result in much learning because the kids are going to be distracted anyhow. So there you go. It's kind of a mixed bag.
Having said all that, does it seem like we're going to see some learning loss under these conditions, similar to the quote-unquote summer brain drain we often hear about?
Absolutely. This is unfortunate and it's inevitable. And when I asked the educators about this, they agreed that the learning gap between students who have good online access and those who don't is only going to widen. The question is how much. Brandywine's superintendent told me that he expects teachers are going to have to be doing catch-up work with some students, not only this September, but next September as well. The head of the Eastside Charter School is fearful that elementary students who fall farther behind in reading now may have trouble catching up by the time they get into high school. And he points out that nobody's going to give these kids a free pass 5 or 6 years from now because they lost half a semester of learning time to coronavirus this year.
And finally, there are some practical matters to consider, especially for high school seniors, proms, graduation, AP testing, and such. How are these being addressed right now?
Well, I can give you an easy answer for AP testing. The exams are being shortened from 3 hours down to 45 minutes. They're going to be offered online so students can take them at home. Final exams for the international baccalaureate classes, which are offered at 5 schools in Delaware, have been canceled. So students students in the IB program are either going to get diplomas or certificates based on the work that they've already completed. Now, as for the proms, schools that had them scheduled for April or for early May are now going about setting new dates. Schools that have prom dates in late May are checking out venues and dates that might be available a little bit later on in, you know, in June or perhaps into the summer, just in case they have to make the change. Graduation really doesn't seem to be an issue yet. The ceremonies at most schools occur during the first 10 days of June, and the hope is that everybody's going to be back up and running by then. There may be some issues if your final exams get deferred and so on. Did check with the University of Delaware, since many of the Newcastle County public high schools use the UD's Bob Carpenter Center as their graduation venue, and UD says no decisions have been made with regard to use of the Bob. So right now, it's all systems go there, but that's subject to change. The attitude across the board is that high schools want to get their seniors across the finish line. If that makes their prom a midsummer's night dream, well, so be it. If commencement has to be delayed until August, well, then that's where it's going to be. As one educator put it, these kids have given us 12 years of their lives. We owe them a fitting send-off.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. You can read his piece on how schools around the state are ramping up remote teaching during the coronavirus outbreak right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We'll hear what the University of Delaware's efforts to move classes online starting Monday will look like. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The University of Delaware was the site of the first confirmed cases of the new coronavirus disease, COVID-19, here in Delaware. The university responded by suspending classes, moving up, then extending spring break, closing its residence halls, and promising a move to online-only courses starting this Monday. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Sharon Pitt, Vice President for Information Technologies and Chief Information Officer at UD, and Lynn Okagaki, Deputy Provost for Academic Affairs, about how the school plans to make this transition.
Lynn, can you start us off by describing what a typical course would look like in the new online format?
Sure. Well, first, let me say that, the University of Delaware is like a big ocean liner, with 18,000 undergraduates, 4,000 grad students, and 1,300 faculty. So we've asked people to try to turn this big ship on a dime, and I think that faculty and staff have really stepped up to the challenge. Some have taught online before for years, and they're helping their colleagues, and others are new to teaching virtually, and I think they've really jumped in to embrace the technology and revise their courses. But I'll give you an example. So some courses are easy to think about doing this. And so if you have a course that's typically done with a lecture, some of our faculty are using this opportunity to do what we call flipped classes. So they are recording their lecture so that students can listen to it at any time. And then they're using the regularly scheduled class time to be a time when faculty will use Zoom and be able to interact, answer questions from their students, and maybe clarify concepts, things like that. So that's one thing that will happen.
Got it. Okay. And so you mentioned the video conferencing platform Zoom. I'm curious, does the university have the digital infrastructure to move all of these classes online? Sharon, can you tell us a little bit about the logistics of the transition?
Sure, absolutely. We are very fortunate to have many tools that are available to our faculty and to our students to be able to be in the online environment. We have a learning management system, which is Canvas, We have classroom recording tools and what is our Unity Capture tool. We have our video conferencing kind of capability, which is the Zoom tool, which Lynn referred to. We have software as a service that allows students to both download tools that they might want to use for productivity associated with their courses, but we also have specialty software for the science, technology fields, things like Mathematica and Stata and SPSS, very specific kind of tools that are needed for the success of these students. And our library, museums, and press is a part of this as well in terms of the access to online journals. As well as a new service that we're rolling out called Yellow Dig, which allows course engagement in many of the courses to just enrich discussion. So we have a very full-featured portfolio of tools that allow learning to happen in many, many different kinds of ways. And we have a very robust infrastructure to try and support that on our campus.
So I imagine different courses would translate online differently. Are there some courses that are really hard to transform to this format? And how is UD helping those faculty members do it?
Sure. This is Lynn. So you can imagine that lab classes in our many of our science lab classes could be really difficult. And one of the things that we're working with faculty to do is to do the lab demonstration and record it themselves so that students can observe the techniques that are used. We have faculty who are going out and into the field because they have to, you know, it's a course on insects, and they are going out and videoing the insects in the field as they would have done, taken students into the field to do observations in the field. Other classes I think that are difficult to translate might be some of our music and art classes. So we've worked out so that if, it's easy for students to and faculty to use Zoom for a one-on-one lesson, say if you're taking violin, for example. If it's more of an ensemble, we've suggested that for duets, you can have one student play his or her part and record it, send that recording to the other student who records himself or herself playing with the recorded music. So you get the two blended together. It's a little more difficult when you think about an orchestra and how we're going to do that. And we haven't, quite honestly, worked out all of those answers yet.
You know, I can add as a general aside, my husband is actually a student in the art conservation program, and he has all of his paints and such at home for his color mixing and matching course. And his faculty member is going to record and give lectures, and the students are going to be using Zoom so that the faculty member can review and comment on their work from wherever it is that they happen to be doing their color mixing and matching.
So what about students who don't have access to Wi-Fi or a computer at home?
I think it's good to know that the Federal Communications Commission has put out a pledge that many people are signing, many corporations are signing, which is called a Keep Americans Connected. And we've made available on our Learn From Home site. So if you go to the udel.edu/coronavirus site, there are sections on learning from home, teaching from home, and working from home. And the learning from home provides information about the different kinds of internet connectivity that can be provided, as well as the corporations that are trying to provide either very reduced cost plans or no cost plans for our students to be able to access internet. With regard to laptops, we are trying to find every single laptop across the institution that's not in use somewhere. and our IT division can take those in, make sure that they are appropriately secured. And for those students who really need it, we're trying to make sure that those laptops are available to them for that kind of access to take their courses. Well, and I know you've been working on this as well from the Office of the Provost perspective, if you wanted to add anything to that.
I think one of the other things is that for students who don't have ready access to computers and internet, that is one reason for students who are in the residence halls to stay in the residence hall.
For many very, very, very rural areas, there is not necessarily internet connectivity that can even be provided. So one's absolutely right. We don't want to disenfranchise our students because they live in an area which one calls a last mile connection, and make sure that they have access to these opportunities to continue their education at UPC the rest of the semester.
So in general, I guess, what would you say to any students who are feeling like, you know, if I wanted an online program for school, I could have gotten it for cheaper. You know, I paid for UD with all the in-person contact with professors and hands-on experiential learning, and, you know, now we're moving to online classes.
I think that actually, you know, sometimes online is more expensive to actually produce well. And students will, in my view, a lot of what students are paying for when they come to the University of Delaware is access to our faculty, and it's still our faculty who will be teaching these courses, and faculty will be available in their virtually, you know, for office hours and other interaction with their students.
I think that's a really good point, Lynn. The exceptional faculty and programs that we have here are something that I think our students are going to want to have access to and continue their instruction the rest of the semester. You know, we're in an emergency event, and I've just been so proud and pleased of the work, as you mentioned at the beginning of this, of our faculty, of the staff, of the people who are supporting them and supporting the students to make sure that they have the best possible University of Delaware experience while we're in this very challenging moment.
Lynn and Sharon, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks to UD's Sharon Pitt and Lynn Okagaki and our Sophia Schmidt for their time on The Green this week. And we wrap up the show next with Enlighten Me, where we get some expert advice on helping kids navigate the coronavirus pandemic. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The coronavirus outbreak is uncharted territory, leaving all of us struggling to process what's going on and what it means to us and our families. And that's just as true for kids as it is for adults, maybe even more so, as children are asked to learn at home instead of school and maintain social distancing that separates them from their friends. So how should parents talk to their kids about the virus and how it's changing their worlds? For this week's Enlighten Me, Megan Walls, a pediatric psychologist at Nemours AI DuPont Hospital for Children, joins me to offer some guidance. All parents face instances where they need to have, you know, hard conversations with their kids, talk about difficult topics, but this one seems different, and not just because of its scope, but in other situations, parents may have personal experiences they can draw on, examples they can use to help explain things, some kind of roadmap to follow. Does engaging kids on this situation present a fairly unique challenge for parents?
Yeah, you know, I've been saying to parents a lot lately that I think just as this is a novel virus, this is a really novel situation. Most parents and kids haven't been in the situation where everyone is quarantined in a house together and we're all, you know, sort of told we're not sure when this is going to end or what's going to happen. So a lot of the unknown makes this really different, I think, than the usual conversation. But what I've been talking to parents about a lot is that it's something that we have to figure out how to address, because our kids know something is up, right? Whether they're 4 or 20, they're well aware that something's going on here. So I've been encouraging parents to kind of reach out to your kids and ask what they know. So what have you heard? What do you know? For the really little guys, it might be, you know, a really quick conversation about something like there's a virus or a sickness, and we're just going to stay at home for now. You know, it doesn't have to be more complicated than that. But as kids get older, they have questions. So, you know, finding out what they know and then asking, what are your questions and how can I help you? I really, really encourage parents to be as honest as they can. So we don't need to tell kids every single thing. And in fact, for older kids, making sure they're not consuming just social media information is really important. But if your kids ask you, you know, is this a serious virus? It's okay to say yes. And scientists and doctors are trying to figure out what that means and how to help us. If kids ask things like, are people dying? The response that I think is really appropriate is, there are some people who seem to get really ill. Most of them already have something else going on, and they do die just like other people die from other illnesses. And, you know, giving them the correct, fair, and honest answers, but not, you know, we don't have to give kids these two-hour conversations about this. And then giving them the opportunity by saying to them, please come ask me questions if you have them. I'm happy to talk to you, but not dwelling on it. So trying to find that balance is pretty tricky. And I think the other tricky part is that kids are supposed to be doing schoolwork. Parents are supposed to be working. And it's really figuring out also how to navigate this new quote-unquote normal for now.
Yeah, I want to dive into a couple of these different things you touched on there. And one is, this approach to children. You mentioned kind of engaging them a little bit in conversation, and not waiting for them to come to you. Is it also important to maybe kind of continually kind of just check in with them and just kind of take their temperature on how they're feeling and what's going on at any given time, and not just to feel like, okay, I have one conversation with them. If they don't come back to me, everything's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a really nice and easy way to do that is, you don't have to tell them this, but just kind of think about, oh, I asked them on Monday, maybe, you know, in 3 or 4 days on Wednesday or Thursday, I'll check in with them. And if they don't have questions, not pushing it. So especially for our younger guys, I think they were all really confused in the beginning, but kids are pretty resilient. A lot of them are taking this sort of as, all right, well, now we're home, so let's make the most of it. But making sure you're still checking in. I think a lot of kids have a lot of questions, and understandably, it's anxiety provoking. Never in any of our lives before have we all been told, stay home, don't go out. There's a really scary virus out there. So, you know, finding that balance, I think, is really important.
You mentioned, you know, tough questions, and there are some questions that kids are going to have that parents just may not be able to answer on their own. You know, what are some of the best ways to handle those kind of questions where you're like, hey, that's a question I have too?
Yeah. So I think a couple things. One is you have to be comfortable saying to your kids, you know, I don't know that answer. Let me get back to you. It's just like we would say, you know, if someone asks a question at work we didn't know, we're going to figure it out. We're going to figure this out together. But it's okay to say you don't know. I really encourage folks to look to experts. So a lot of pediatric experts are doing videos and articles. Nemours Kids Health has quite a few both articles and YouTube videos about how to talk to your kids and or how do we talk to kids about the things they do have control about. So I think those are two categories, right? We have that sort of let's teach kids about social distancing and washing your hands and let's give them some control. And then the second piece of how do we talk about this if it is making kids upset or anxious. So I think certainly it's okay to not know the answer. That's what we're here for. And to kind of say, I'll go look for that answer. For your older kids, it's okay for teenagers to have them involved with you. So let's go look together at a really reputable source versus let's see what your friend put on Snapchat, right, about whatever's going on, because those are not the best ways to get information. But a lot of our teenagers are getting it that way. And when I'm doing, you know, telehealth with kids, I think that's one of the things I'm making sure to also tell families. So watch where the information is actually coming in from for your kids.
I was going to say news coverage, social media, virtually impossible to avoid. And certainly the information it provides on this outbreak is almost impossible to avoid. How can parents kind of keep that flood of information from creating anxiety without, you know, basically telling your kids, you know, don't go on social media, don't watch TV type of response?
So I think there's two pieces to this. I think there's our younger kids. Turn off your TV. Turn off your news when your kids are in the room, if you're eating dinner together. Another really important piece is adults are talking almost over kids about this. So, you know, I've heard neighbors even talking about, oh, I'm so scared of this or that. Make sure you're checking your conversations when your little guys are around. honesty doesn't mean we're flooding them with information. For your older kids, I actually strongly encourage, and this is across the board, but even more now, to have a time of night where teenagers, you know, put their phones outside their room or in a basket, or adults take them, because they can go down a rabbit hole really quickly and you're not really able to catch on there. But I think also having a really honest conversation with your kids. There's only so much news we can all take in. We'll make sure to tell you what's going on. But, you know, as a teenager, I really encourage you to turn off your phone or to turn off the news feed even. You know, text your friends, but don't be on the news feed that you're reading, Twitter, and to have that honest conversation. Because I think the truth is it's a trap we're all falling into right now, whether it's kids or adults. And sure. So we need to be able to set good models.
Another source of anxiety could be parents themselves. They're, as you mentioned, you know, they're working at home where kids can see the stress that they're dealing with, or maybe dealing with job loss, while they're also trying to, as you said, manage the kids who are at home trying to learn. Is that something parents really need to be mindful of, is, you know, realizing their kids can kind of see them in their work environment and whatever stress they're going through?
Absolutely. So one of the things I've been talking a lot to parents about is quantity time over quality time. We are all in the same space right now, but that doesn't mean that your kids are getting from you what they need. And in fact, it might mean exactly what you're saying, which is they're actually seeing you at a different stress level and a different presentation than normal. And so making sure you're balancing that, because we can't just say we're not going to work or we're not going to be stressed about work, especially those of us in the healthcare world. But what we can say is, I'm going to make time for you and I'm going to make sure I'm connecting with you. So what I've been encouraging parents to do is look at your schedule, you know, ahead of time. Find maybe a 15-minute break in your morning, a 15-minute break in your afternoon, and then a family dinner time if you can, and sort of address that with your kids. Hey, I'm really busy today. I know mommy looks stressed. I'm really okay. This is just how work goes sometimes. At 2:15 today, do you want to play a card game with me? Kids are really resilient, and so are teens. So if you can kind of give them that balance, it really, really helps.
There's also the issue of older relatives, like grandparents. Kids are, you know, being asked essentially, hey, you avoid contact with, you know, grandma or grandpa. Is that something that's also, you know, your parents have to really kind of have a strategy for?
Yeah, so I think this is a really hard one. I personally have young kids who don't understand. You know, my 5-year-old asks pretty much every other day why Grammy can't come over, because she's pretty used to seeing her. So we've had a conversation again, and I've encouraged parents to do this about we can still have social connections without seeing people in person. So, you know, helping your grandparents get set up on FaceTime or Zoom or any of those things is great. And honestly, it's beneficial for both of them, right? But I think, again, it goes back to the honesty piece. We can't say to our kids something like, well, we'll see them soon, if we don't know that that's the truth. Instead, what we can say is, I really miss grandma, grandpa, your friend, whomever it is, too. I also really wish we could see them. We talked about why that's not safe right now. What else can we do to help you? And another thing I've been encouraging is, you know, good old, like, snail mail and sending letters. Kids aren't really doing that as much these days, and they're really enjoying it when I've suggested it to some folks. So I think there's other ways we can connect, but I still think it's important to be honest with kids.
And let's talk about the social interaction for kids, because obviously they're somewhat cut off from their own friends, no school, activity, sports canceled. You know, for tweens and teens who are already interacting by text, instant messaging, social media and such, maybe that's less of an issue. But for younger kids who parents might have been reluctant to allow them into those realms just yet, should they seek opportunities maybe to let their kids connect online with their friends to socialize and open that door a little bit?
You know, there's been a couple really great things that have happened. One thing that it has been, I've checked it out in detail, is Facebook has created a kids messenger account. So parents have to have an account and approve other kids to talk to your kids. But my second grader, for instance, is able to do math this morning with one of her good friends on that. It works sort of like FaceTime. I think you can let your kids use your phone. So as long as you're supervising, right, as long as you know what they're doing, I actually really encourage it. But I think if you can take the approach of, I want my kids to be safe but also social, then you can explore some of these options. I know a lot of classrooms are using Zoom. I think that's a great idea. But the two things that I've seen kids use that I think are pretty safe is like FaceTime to people they know, and this Facebook Kids Messenger app. They've both been pretty great to see kids being able to interact with each other without the worry of, you know, sort of the public eye on them.
And finally, are there any things parents should look for as reasons to be concerned that maybe their child is having more difficulty than would normally be expected?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I think that's always my last point whenever I'm speaking on any of these things. So the things we look for are really a change in your kids' functioning. And what I mean by that is they're not sleeping. They're not eating. They're crying more. They're upset more. Maybe they are unable to, you know, get up and do the things they need to do. And if that's happening, really, I encourage parents to reach out to either your pediatrician or if you have a mental health provider. You know, the positive thing in this pandemic is that behavioral health providers, so pediatric psychologists, adult psychologists, social workers have managed to move our practice mostly to telehealth and telemedicine. So certainly, you know, parents should reach out if they're having a hard time with their kiddos and they really think it's not a normal adjustment to some of these things. We really encourage people to reach out at this time. And again, we're lucky because we're able to mostly do telehealth with our patients and clients so that we can make sure that we're taking care of kids as they need.
Thanks to Megan Walls, a pediatric psychologist at Nemours AI DuPont Hospital for Children, for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors John Hurdle and Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.